Angelica Sinitsky.
Hi, and welcome to episode 63. The numbers keep climbing of Spurbs Herbs. And today we are going to be talking about Mi Meng Hua. Those tone marks correct. Mi Meng Hua, or Buddleia floss, also known as Buddleia flower bud. So an interesting herb. Let's find out some more about it. Today we'll be looking at another Chinese herb. This is a Chinese herb, in case you couldn't tell from the name, Mi Meng Hua, or Buddleia flower bud. This is an herb in the herbs that drain fire subcategory of the herbs that clear heat category. So, you know, the books are in chapters, and those are the categories, and there's subsections under each of those chapters. That is the subcategory. So it's the chapter of clear heat, and the subsection is herbs that drain fire. While not one of the most commonly used of Chinese herbs, it still has some interesting uses, especially when it comes to the liver and the eyes. Join us as we look at this herb, as well as usual, exploring something a little different. We are going to introduce the Chinese medical pulse. We've talked about it. We've referred to it. Now we're going to actually do a deep dive into it to a certain extent. We're going to do this over several episodes. It's the first one. The episodes won't be back-to-back, otherwise we'd be doing it for a year only. So, but we're going to start our exploration of the Chinese medical pulse. It's going to be another interesting and terrific episode. Before we get into it, I just want to remind everyone, we have started a new webinar series, and I wanted to let you, my podcast listeners, know about it before we got too far into it. It is integrative nutrition, and will cover biomedical and Chinese concepts of nutrition and explore the complementary and alternative concepts that are part of the modern supplement industry. This series will be one live class per month covering a category of nutrition and will include some basic biochemistry, nutrition, and supplements available on the market. Plus, I'm going to put a Chinese medical spin on things. In other words, it's going to be the perfect combination of biochemical nutrition, supplements, Chinese medicine, and real-world use cases. If you are a practitioner of any stripe or just interested in nutrition, this is real nutrition. This isn't the fake stuff. This isn't what you hear by people trying to sell things. This is real stuff, and it's raw. Like, I will say, the evidence on this is nothing. This is a waste of your money. Don't buy it. I have said that already. We've done several episodes already, so that is how this is. This is the series for you if you're just interested in nutrition and not a practitioner. But if you are a practitioner, you're going to get a lot out of it. In fact, that's why I'm doing it, is because as a practitioner, I keep seeing supplements that I recognize because I understand biochemistry, but I have no idea what they're supposed to do as supplements or why they're supplements or if they work or anything like that. So this was me as a practitioner trying to answer those questions. That's the bottom line here, is it is really, it's not just geared for practitioners, though practitioners I think will get more out of it. It is for lay people as well. It's a little advanced, but it is definitely helpful for anyone who's interested in nutrition. And you can sign up for the first class or the whole series at www.integrativemedicinecouncil.org. I will only be teaching each class live one time. After that, it will only be available as a recording. I am revising that a little bit because I think I'm two or three episodes into it at this point. We're doing our next one as this is be recording next week. I got to say, I didn't include enough Chinese medicine as I was doing it. I was just, you know, the first few episodes are always like, you got to get all your sources together and everything. And now I'm starting to hit my stride and I really want to include a lot more. So I'm going to go back when I'm done. I'm going to go back and do the first few again, but only the first few. So there you go. So don't miss this opportunity to learn about a topic all our patients ask about and get a firm understanding of the basics of integrated nutrition. Okay, and as I said, we're going to talk about pulse diagnosis, which is an incredibly important cornerstone of Chinese medical diagnostics. Let's get into it without further ado. We have mentioned different pulses at various times when discussing herbs, yet we have not done a good overview of the Chinese pulse-taking system, and that ends now. And over time, we'll discuss all the various pulse qualities. We're not going to talk really pulse qualities today. We're just going to talk about the basics of taking the pulse, why you take it, what it tells us in general terms. But we are, over time, going to talk about all the different pulse qualities. There are 28 different pulse qualities, so it's going to take us a little while to get over to do all of them. If you're a practitioner, this should be a good refresher for you. And if you're not a practitioner, this will be a great introduction to one of the most fundamental and powerful diagnostic tools of Chinese medicine. So Maciocha is, if you're not familiar with Giovanni Maciocha, he is just one of the foundational people in Chinese medicine. He, 20, 30, when I was in school, so that's over 30 years ago, so probably 30, 40 years ago, he published one of the first, comprehensive basic texts for Chinese medicine. He translated a lot of Chinese into that. He's just foundational, one of the foundational authors. He has many, many textbooks, all of which are widely used in Chinese medical schools. He's just an amazing guy and a really nice guy. I worked with him for many years, so he's just a terrific guy. He did pass a couple of years ago, sadly, but he did leave us a great resource. And this is one of the book today that a lot of this comes from is the basic tech Chinese medical textbook. This is, when you're in your first semester in Chinese medical school, you get your herb book, which we will refer to a lot today, and you get your Chinese medical theory book. Those are the two big ones. And usually you have to take some anatomy, so there's an anatomy book, there's some other books. But these books, the herb book and Maciocha's book, kind of hold you out for at least a year or two in classes. They're big, thick books. No, Maciocha's become a big, thick book. It was kind of thin when I went to school. Thinner, at least half the size, but really foundational stuff. So this is the foundational stuff that we're talking about here. So Maciocha says pulse diagnosis is important for two reasons. Firstly, because it can give very detailed information on the state of the internal organs, and secondly, because it reflects the whole complex of qi and blood. If you're not familiar about qi and blood, that is one of the four vital substances, along with yin and yang, which one of these days we'll talk about the four vital. We've talked about them individually, but maybe not as the vital substances in this podcast. So the pulse can be seen, again, still quoting Maciocha, the pulse can be seen as a clinical manifestation, a sign like any other, such as thirst, insomnia, or a red face. The important difference is that, besides giving certain specific indications, the pulse also reflects the organism as a whole, the state of qi, blood, and yin, the yin and yang organs, all parts of the body, and even the constitution of a person. That's the end of the quote. I often refer to the pulse diagnosis as Chinese medicine's MRI, magnetic resonance, resonant inference. It's imaging. It's basically allows us to have an insight into the human body. And let me tell you, if you get your pulse taken by a master of pulse diagnosis, it's revelatory. I mean, this person, I still remember one of the first, it was my martial arts instructor. I think it was my martial arts instructor. And he took my pulse and he reached behind my back and he put his hand on my back and he said, "This is where it hurts, isn't it?" I said, "Yeah, it's been killing me." He knew just from my pulse, exactly on my back, where it was bothering me. And that was like when I first said, "Okay, there might be something here." Okay, so while the pulse can be taken from many areas of the body, as in biomedicine, we have lots of different dorsalis pedis pulse in the back of the foot. We have the jugular, the carotid pulse. There's lots of different pulses, temporal pulses, that can be taken for various reasons. And same in Chinese medicine. You read some of the old books, they talk about all the different pulse positions. But the classic of difficulties, or Nanjing, compiled in the first century CE, established the radial artery, which is felt just before the wrist on the lateral or thumb side, as the standard position for pulse diagnosis. So that is where we are. You can't see me. This is, if you can see me, there you go. It's on this side near the thumb. And that's where we really take the pulse diagnosis. It's the common pulse point when you go to a doctor, a Western doctor, they will take your pulse there. They may also take pulses other where just to make sure. So like if they think there might be some circulatory issues, they may take your pulse at the foot. There's a couple pulse positions at the foot, but the standard pulse position is right there at the radial artery near your wrist. The text, the Nanjing, the text also established the pulse should be taken at three depths, superficial, middle, and deep, as well as three positions. These three positions are known as the sun or inch, guan or bar or gate, and qir or cubit or foot. Now, I say qir because one of my first Chinese teachers was from Taiwan, and they kind of put an R on that I, but a lot of people say qi. This is not the qi of what we're taught, you know, what we talk about as important in Chinese medicine. This is a different qi. Probably a different tone mark, though I don't have tone marks here. And it's spelled different. It's C-H-I rather than Q-I. So it is a different word. And it's often translated as cubit or foot pulse. With these, there are therefore nine pulse positions at east wrist, or with both hands, 18 different pulse positions that we will observe, we will look at. This is getting complicated. This complicated system is worth mentioning. Learning to take the pulse is difficult and can be subjective. Maciolcha says, quote, "The main drawback of pulse diagnosis is that it is an extremely subjective form of diagnosis, probably more than any other element of Chinese diagnosis. If a face is red or if a tongue is red, these are quite objective signs and anyone can see them. Feeling the pulse is an extremely subtle skill and is very difficult to learn." And in support of this, what I used to tell them when I teach this to my students, and I used to teach, like, it was the history and foundations, it was the first class in the program, and we start to dive into some of these things. And then I've taught other classes where we did teach the pulse directly. But I would tell my students in both of those situations, "I'm going to explain pulse diagnosis in this class, and it will take the rest of your life to master it. This is not an easy thing to master. It's quite a skill." That isn't to say along the way, even if you can't master all the different pulse qualities, that you don't get any information from the pulse. You can still get a lot of information from a pulse, even if you're not a master of it. As I would say, I'd be hard-pressed to call myself a master of pulse diagnosis, and I would say probably most practitioners aren't, quote-unquote, masters a pulse diagnosis. And if you're not sure about it, just ask any of them and say, "Well, do you consider anyone to be a master of pulse diagnosis?" And they usually have one or two people in mind that they would consider masters, and it's not themselves. And so they're relatively rare, but we all know how to take the pulse at certain level that is clinically effective. So even if we're not masters, it's still useful. Okay. We've established 18 pulse positions, and yes, there can be differences in the pulse between each of them. Yes, but I think, you know, what I find is early students put too much emphasis on the subtle differences between each of these different positions, and kind of forget the overall quality, which is probably more important than any subtle differences in each position. But yeah, you can feel differences in each of these different positions. But what do these pulses tell us? There's a lot that they can tell us, and several different cognitive overlays exist for that information, and we're going to talk about a few of those. The first and most straightforward is the three positions, the inch, the bar, and the cubit. These can refer to the three burners, with the inch most distal, which means closest to the hand, pulse representing the upper burner, basically the chest, heart, and lungs. The middle or bar position represents the middle burner and the gallbladder, liver, spleen, and stomach, kind of our digestive systems. And the most proximal position, the cubit position, which is the furthest away from the wrist, representing the lower burner, bladder, small and large intestines, and the kidneys. So that's just general, just by getting those three different positions. In a more philosophical approach, these three positions can represent heaven, most distal, human, middle, and earth, proximal positions. So this is very, very, in Taoist philosophy, we often talk about heaven and earth with humans or mankind or humankind in between heaven and earth. And that is very, very foundational to Taoist thinking. And so here, that's a philosophical approach that we can look at here. And of course, when we look at that, that's called Tian Ren Di, by the way, in Chinese, Tian Ren Di, so heaven, human. Ren is often translated as man or mankind or humankind. And then earth is Di, so Tian Ren Di. And that, you know, that's one real interesting overlay because, you know, one is what we're striving for to as we enter heaven. One is what we struggle with as we deal with earth. And we're in between those to a certain extent. I like also putting in, and this is not traditional. This is just my over, you know, thinking about this stuff over years. I like to put in the idea of super ego, ego, and id into these as well, with earth being our id or animal nature, and then ego being our human nature, and super ego being kind of our communal or higher than individual sort of approach to this. And again, not traditional. It's very Freudian in its approach, and I'm not suggesting it's, you know, it's the end all be all of how to look at this, but it's one other overlay you can put on top of this as well. And then after those three positions, we have the three depths, or at least two of them can interact with these three positions. Generally, the superficial depth corresponds with yang organs of the body, while deep depth corresponds with the yin organs of the body. I think we've talked about yin and yang organs in the past, or zhang fu, you know, organs. That's what they're in Chinese medicine. We also call them the solid organs versus the hollow organs being yang, solid organs being yin. And if that sounds a little weird, but think about it a little bit, you know, we have as hollow organs, we have our bladder and our gallbladder and our small intestine, our large intestine. Those are all going to be considered hollow organs. Well, most of the rest are going to be solid organs or yin. You know, we have the triple burn, which is a yang organ, nothing associated with Western medicine at all. And then the pericardium is another one, which is a separate yang organ. It's very interesting. So did I get that right? No, I did not get that right. Pericardium is considered a solid organ, which is weird. What am I missing? I'm missing one of the hollow organs. It'll come. Oh, the stomach, of course. Probably the most important yang organ. So yeah, those are all hollow. So this idea of superficial being yang and deep being yin makes sense generally as yang is up and more superficial while yin is down and deep. The middle depth is said to reflect the blood. So it's kind of in between the organs. Different sources may give different organ correspondences to these three positions and depths. Though currently we generally use, when I say we generally use, I mean those who are learning Chinese medicine today generally use the correspondences as discussed in the Pulse Classic or Mai Jing, written in 280 CE. That is available as a translation. I do own it. So it's a surprisingly large book for an ancient text. On the left, the distal inch position represents the small intestine yang in the superficial depth and the heart yin at the deep depth. The middle or bar position represents the gallbladder yang superficially and the liver yin deeply. And the proximal or cubit position represents the bladder yang superficially and the kidney yin at depth. The kidney here is generally thought to represent the kidney yin. We'll see why that's important in just a second. The kidney, remember, well, we haven't really talked about it, but the kidney stores both the yin and the yang. So there's a kidney yin and a kidney yang aspect to the kidney, unlike all the other organs. So on the right, the distal inch position represents the large intestine yang in the superficial depth and the lungs yin at the deep depth. The middle or bar position represents the stomach yang superficially and the spleen yin deeply. And the proximal or cubit position represents the triple burner yang superficially and the kidney yin, this time the kidney yang at depth. So when I'm saying kidney yin in parentheses, that is indicating that it's a yin organ, but we're really looking at the kidney yang on the right side and the kidney yin on the left side. The classic of difficulty says the right deep position is the pericardium rather than the kidney again. So instead of having two kidneys, it has one kidney on the left, and on the right, it actually has the pericardium organ. And that actually makes a little bit of logical sense. And let's face it, there's not necessarily a lot of logic to this, because earlier we just said these positions represent the triple burners. And if you look at what I just said, or read what I just said, or listen to what I just said, we have the small intestine in the distal position, which is the upper burner. The small intestine is considered lower burner. And same on the right, we have the large intestine in the distal position, which is the upper burner, not the lower burner. So really, when we're looking at the organs, we're kind of looking at the organ pairs, the yin-yang pairs, and coupling those together, and kind of disregarding the three burners. And so there's a little bit of an internal discrepancy here, which is fine. There's a lot of that in a lot of medicine. So we'll talk about that a little bit more in just a minute. So I remember these positions using the mnemonic, the Hulk Lisps. So the heart, liver, and kidneys on the left, the lungs, spleen, and pericardium on the right. So HLK for Hulk, and Lisps, lungs, spleen, and pericardium on the right. So the Hulk Lisps. Lisps. It's not easy to say, but it's easy to remember. So other ways to interpret the three depths include the superficial level reflects exterior conditions, the middle depth reflects stomach and spleen conditions, and the deep level reflects interior conditions. Another interpretation by Li Shizhen, who wrote the pulse study of Binhu Lake or Binhu Mai Shui in 1564, says the superficial level reflects the heart and lungs, the middle depth reflects the stomach and spleen, and the deep level the liver and kidneys. So that's all really helpful, gives us an overview of how to interpret this, but how do we actually take the pulse to begin with? So the best time, though not possible most of the time, is the early morning when the yin is calm and the yang has not come forth as of yet. So the Chinese day starts at 3 a.m., so taking the pulse around 4 or 5 is probably ideal. Very yin at that point, very calm, and it's not a lot of yang flowing as of yet. But then again, those of us in practice rarely see our patients at 4 or 5 in the morning. I don't know about you. I'd choose a different career if I had to do that every day. And that's someone I did wake up at 3:30 every morning to commute 2 hours to work, 2.5 hours to work for years. But still, wouldn't want to do that all the time. So that's best time, but we often do it in not the best time. The arm should be no higher than the level of the heart and should not cross the body. I often have to remind my patients to relax and to let me hold the weight of the arm if they are sitting. If they're laying down, the arm should be straight on the table. Though I have had practitioners, and I have done it, you know, fold the arms loosely over and have them on the stomach. The fingers of the pulse taker should be placed so the index finger is on the distal inch position, the middle is on the bar, and the ring finger is on the cubit position. The thumb should never be used to take any pulse ever. The thumb has its own pulse. It will interfere with any pulse taking, so never use your thumb. My martial arts instructor said one should always use the same hand to take the pulse because it is easier to train one hand rather than two. This may require curling the hand and fingers under the arm rather than placing them on top. So, you know, often we take the pulse. I don't know if I can get a good view. There we go, like this. But to get the positions correctly, we may need to curl them around like this. Now, here's the thing with that. Giovanni specifically says you should be using both hands, taking the pulse, both arms at the same time. That certainly is a very valid and standard technique for this, and I will do that myself. But I like what my martial arts instructor said, you know, someone who definitely is all about training both sides of the, you know, that we all have dominance and you have to deal with that in martial arts training. I like that he said that it's easier to train one hand over the other. So I predominantly use my right hand because I'm right-handed, but I often will also use both hands at the same time when I'm trying to compare sides. But generally, I'll use one in my right hand predominantly. Once positioned, the fingers may need to be arranged appropriately. If a patient has large arms, the pulse taker may need to spread the fingers a little. If it is small, they may have to press them close together. The fingertips should be resting over the pulse for the most part. The fingers should move slightly to get various aspects of the pulse. These can include lifting upwards, pressing downwards, pushing from side to side, and rolling, which is proximal, the distal movement of the fingers. So proximal to distal means towards the body and away from the body. Finally, the pulse taker should relax and regulate and balance their breathing. Several pulse qualities, which we will discuss over time, require comparing the pulse with the pulse taker's breathing. In other words, there are a certain number of pulses that should happen per breath. That's not per patient's breath, it's per the pulse taker's breath. And so the pulse taker needs to be relaxed and have regulated breathing while doing this. And doing that also helps you feel the pulse more appropriately and objectively as well. So these are the basics of taking the pulse and the beginning of understanding what it is saying. Over time, we will discuss the specific pulse qualities practitioners look for in the pulse. There are 28 of them. Some are very straightforward. Others require lots of experience with a mentor to accurately differentiate, and even then it's difficult. Before we discuss any of these different pulses, let's end today's introduction with a discussion of what is a normal pulse. There needs to be three pulse qualities in order for it to be considered normal. Stomach qi, spirit, and having root. Stomach qi, according to Machiocha, a pulse is said to have stomach qi when it feels gentle, calm, and is relatively slow, 4 beats per respiratory cycle. A pulse with stomach qi is not rough. The stomach is the sea of food, the root of the post-heaven qi, and the origin of qi and blood. For this reason, it gives body to the pulse. If the pulse feels too rough or hard, it indicates that the stomach's function is impaired. This particular quality of being soft but not too soft, gentle, calm, and not rough, is important. Beginners often take a rough and hard quality of the pulse as being healthy. Spirit of the pulse. The pulse is said to have spirit when it is soft but with strength, neither big nor small, and regular. It should also be regular in its quality, that is, it should not change quality very easily and frequently. A pulse that has these qualities reflects a good state of heart qi and blood. And finally, the root. A pulse is said to have root in 2 different senses. It has a root when the deep level can be felt clearly, and also when the rear position can be felt clearly. Rear position being the proximal position or cubit position. Having a root indicates that the kidneys are healthy and strong. Thus, a pulse that has spirit, stomach qi, and root indicates a good state of the mind, qi, and essence, respectively. Machiocha has a step-by-step process for assessing the pulse. 1, feel the pulse as a whole. 2, feel whether the pulse has spirit, stomach, qi, and root. 3, feel the 3 levels and the 3 positions. 4, feel the strength of the pulse. 5, feel the overall quality of the pulse, if there is one, and we'll talk about that later, as we've said. And 6, feel the quality of individual pulse positions. So overall and then individual positions. And that is an introduction to taking the Chinese medical pulse. We'll be exploring this more in future Superbs episodes, as I've mentioned. And now, without further ado, let's get into our herb for today. We are going to be talking about Mingmenghua or Buddleia flower bud. The family here is, according to Bensky, is the Longaniaceae family. However, more recent studies placed it in the Scrofulariaceae family. So again, we see this frequently. These will change as we do genetic studies and things along those lines. And different genuses will be placed in different families. And that happened here. So today it's considered in the Scrofulariaceae family, which we've discussed before. We'll discuss in just a minute. The actual species for this is Buddleia officinalis maxim. The medicinal part is the flower or flower bud. And the English translation of Mingmenghua literally means dense cover flower. Other names for this are pale butterfly bush flower, Menghua, so it just gets rid of the mi, Chang Jianzi, Huangfan Hua, that's usually in Guangxi province, Jinhu Tiaozi, Laomeng Hua, Shui Jin Hua. Hua means flower, so that's why we're seeing it quite a bit here. Yang Cheng Tiao, Yang Duo Duo Jian, which is in Kunming. So that's Yang Duo Duo Jian. And in Japanese, it's Mitsumoka. And in Korean, it's Milmonghwa. All right, so we're going to talk about that Scrofulariaceae family, and let's do that. It is a diverse family known as the figwort or snapdragon family. There are 220 genera and 3,000 species in this family. That's a good size family. These plants generally have symmetrical, two-lipped, tubular forms of the flowers, often borne on long spires. Foxglove or digitalis, a plant in this family, is an important medicinal herb, which is the source of the cardiac glycosides used for treating arrhythmias. This is when a quick side on this is my grandfather was an old school, very old school physician. And when he learned that I was studying herbs and acupuncture and Chinese medicine, he basically said, oh, that's BS, that doesn't do anything. And yet he would also at other times tell us about the story when he was working in the hospital, they would go out back, find foxglove in order to treat the heart patients. I mean, so he used herbs. So whenever he got on me for using herbs, I'd say, yeah, but you. And so we had conversations about that as we went along. So back to the Scrofulariaceae family, which I'm getting better at pronouncing as we go along. It means I'm not drinking probably, which is good. I don't usually drink. So it also includes many ornamental garden plants as well, that family. Okay, so back to Mingmenghua. Bensky and his team say the dosage is 3 to 9 grams. Chen and Chen say the dose is 3 to 10 grams. For some reason, Bensky does things in threes because that's a traditional way to do it. And I find Chen and Chen and Brandon Wiseman usually round to tens. So that's just, you know, stylistic, I think. You know, basically the dosing is the same between these two. But Chen and Chen say it can have up to a maximum of 20 grams. Our third usual text, which is Brandon Wiseman, does not actually have an entry on this herb at all. So that, again, that just solidifies that this is not one of the most commonly used herbs in the Chinese pharmacopoeia. Both of them, as we mentioned, the category here in Bensky is the herbs that drain fire subcategory of the herbs that clear heat. And Chen and Chen almost say the exact same thing, but slightly different verbiage. Says it's in the heat clearing and fire purging herbs subcategory for the heat clearing herbs category. So very, very similar, same concepts, just slightly different translations. Bensky and his team say it's sweet and slightly cool and enters the liver channel. Chen and Chen agrees, but says it's not slightly cool, it's actually cool. So there you go. Zhou and Chen, which is our kind of fourth text, this is the book, the Chinese Medicinal Identification Text, also does not have an entry for this herb. So again, not one of the most popular herbs out there. Still important, though. We're going to talk about why it's useful. So both Bensky and Chen Chen say the original source for this herb is the Kaibao Ben Sao or Materia Medica of the Kaibao era, written by Ma Zhi in 973-974 CE. So this is a good almost 800 years past the earliest text for individual herbs, the Shenkang Ben Sao Jing, which is written in 200 CE. So this is not the latest herb by any stretch of the imagination, but a later addition to the pharmacopoeia. So let's talk about those herbs that clear heat category. So this is the chapter, and then we're going to get into the subchapter in just a minute. So herbs that clear heat category. According to Bensky and his team, heat in traditional Chinese medicine refers not only to febrile diseases or problems attributable to the invasion of pathogenic heat, but also to any condition that presents with heat signs: dry throat, red face, red eyes, dry stools, dark and scanty urine, yellow tongue coating, a rapid pulse, there's one of those pulse qualities we'll get to eventually, and a sensation of warmth in the five centers. The five centers are the soles of the feet, palms of the hand, and the sternum. So they say the sternum here. I've also heard it's the forehead as well. So it kind of depends on which source you're talking about, though. Bensky's text is usually more correct than some of the other things I've heard. So I'd go with sternum. Heat can be found in either the exterior or the interior. Exterior heat presents with fever, chills, headache, thirst, moderate sweating, and a floating rapid pulse. Interior heat presents with fever without chills, dry mouth, thirst, irritability, scanty and dark urine, yellow tongue coating, constipation or diarrhea, and abdominal distension. The herbs in this category are used to treat interior heat. In general, these herbs are cold in nature. We just said it's cool or slightly cool in nature, which is different than cold. Cold is cold. Cool is not as cold. So it's just a degradation thing. Okay, so now we step into the subcategory of herbs that drain fire. And Bensky continues, herbs that drain fire are among the coldest in the Materia Medica. They're used for treating high fever, irritability, thirst, and delirium associated with febrile disease or fever disease. In the four-level Siphon system of differentiation, these symptoms generally correspond to the qi level, and in the six-stage Liao Jing system to the yang brightness stage. Included in this group are herbs used for treating eye problems due to wind heat, as well as heat in the liver, lungs, or stomach. And that's really where our herb is going to sit, is in that last little sentence there. It's going to be eye problems due to wind heat, as well as heat in the liver. Just a little foreboding, foreshadowing. So good quality, according to Bensky, good quality consists of inflorescences. Those are basically flower buds. With densely arranged grayish, brown, soft, and smooth flower buds, and without stalks or foreign matter. Chinese medical actions, according to Bensky and his team, are clears the liver, brightens the eyes, and reduces superficial visual obstruction. And this is used for red, swollen, painful eyes, excessive tearing, superficial visual obstruction, or sensitivity to light. And can be used for problems of either excess or deficiency. This is one of the key qualities of this, is it can be used for either an exterior, an excessive or a vacuous condition. Chen Chen similarly say its functions include clears liver heat, brightens the eyes, and removes superficial visual obstruction. More specifically, they say it can be used for eye disorders caused by either excess or deficiency syndromes, wind heat, liver heat or deficiency heat, or blurred vision from liver vacuity, superficial visual obstruction, or itching eyes. Preparations for this herb. Usually there's lots of different preparations, but neither text actually discusses preparation for this herb, meaning it is probably traditionally used as a powder or decoction. This also supports the fact that the herb is not one of the more commonly used herbs in Chinese medicine. Western uses for this herb. It appears this herb is primarily a Chinese herb, and it was difficult to find any Western herbal entries for this herb. There was one description from a commercial skin product page that discussed the extract of this herb as useful for protection against ultraviolet and blue light, though it offers no references for these assertions. So, you know, that's not really very strong, and it's not really traditional Western uses, maybe a more modern use for it. The PDR for Herbal Medicines, which is a pretty comprehensive text, does not mention this herb, and it's tends towards Western herbs, so it doesn't mention this. We'll cover some of the pharmacological effects of this herb when we talk about science in just a few minutes. Mi Mengua commentary. So usually Bensky has a really good commentary on all these herbs, and they do here too. So according to Bensky, sweet and cool, this herb, I should say Bensky and his team, it's not him alone. Sweet and cool, this herb enters the liver channel at the qi and blood levels. Its sweetness tonifies the blood, and its coldness cools heat. Thus, it cools liver heat, brightens the eyes, and tonifies liver yin and blood that have been injured by fire. This is an important herb for the eyes, and is often used for gradual loss of sight, blurry vision, and visual obstruction. It can be used for both excess, usually the rising of liver, fire, and wind, as well as deficiency, usually fire from liver and kidney deficiency. Materia Medica for decoctions of the Tongye Ben Sao, written in 1306, observes that Buddleia floss, Mi Ming Gua, enters both the qi level and the blood level of the liver channel and moistens liver dryness. The primary in, oh, the and it continues, the commentary on the Divine Husbandman's classic of Materia Medica, or the Benjing Shu Zhang, written in 1837, so almost modern. The primary indications for Buddleia floss, Ming Ming Hua, are exclusively those resulting from liver deficiency with heat. The herb is sweet, so it tonifies blood, cold, so it eliminates heat. When liver blood is sufficient, all these disorders will be cured. So that's the commentary from Bensky. Comparisons. So there are some comparisons. Bensky compares this herb with two others. One of them is Areoculi floss, or Gujing Zhao. Both herbs expel wind and cool heat, benefit the eyes, and reduce superficial visual obstruction. For this reason, they are often combined in the treatment of eye disorders. Areoculi floss, Gujing Zhao, is acrid, sweet, cool, and enters the liver and stomach channels. It's not only good for eye problems, but also for headache and toothache due to wind. Ming Ming Hua is sweet, cold, and also enters the liver channel. Its rising and dispersing nature is not as strong as that of Areoculi floss, Gujing Zhao, but it excels at simultaneously cooling and tonifying. This can be attributed to its sweet flavor, which tonifies liver blood and moistens liver dryness, while its cooling clears liver heat. Because it focuses on the liver, it can be used for all types of eye problems, whether due to deficiency or excess. So this requires a little bit of a thing. So why would, it says, because it focuses on the eye, it can be used for all types of eye problems. Because it focuses on the liver, it can be used for all types of eye problems. That's because the eyes are considered the flower of the liver. That's the actual Chinese term. So all of our senses are connected to different organs, and so the eyes are connected to the liver. So if you benefit the liver, you benefit the eyes. That's basically what that last little bit is saying. So the next herb compared with it is Celeosia semen, or Qingxiangzi. And I just want to say, I haven't used any of these. I mean, this is why I do that. I love superb herbs, is because I get to learn about all this stuff that I don't use in my everyday practice. And I do herbs quite frequently. These are just not commonly used herbs. And I don't have a practice that focuses on eye conditions. I certainly have treated them in my practice, but it isn't my main focus. I have a buddy I went to school with who actually wrote a book on Chinese medicine for eye issues. So he's an expert in the eye stuff. So hopefully, I would imagine he has used these herbs quite a bit. But not me. Okay, so Celeosia semen, or Qingxiangzi, both, so this is compared with Ming Ming Hua, both herbs cool the liver and improve vision and reduce superficial visual obstructions. However, Ming Ming Hua nourishes the liver blood, so the tonification is implicit in its ability to clear heat. Celeosia semen Qingxiangzi, on the other hand, is bitter, cold, sinking, and downward directing. It's only appropriate when liver fire blazes upward and heat toxin flushes the eyes. So very different presentations for these two herbs. Combination. So Bensky and his team does not have any combinations with this herb. Usually they do have some, but Chen Chen had several. So Chen Chen, these are Chen Chen's combinations. Eye disorders caused by wind heat. Use Ming Ming Hua with Juhua floss chrysanthemum. Emudze, Herba Equisetti, Hyemalis, H-I-E-M-A-L-I-S, Hyemalis, okay. So that's for eye disorders caused by wind heat. For eye disorders from liver heat, use it with Baiji Li or Fructus Tribuli, Shijue Ming, Concha Haliotitis, Zhuang Mingzi, Semen Cassia, and Gujing Zhao, Floss Areoculi. That's the one we just talked about. Eye disorders caused by deficiency heat, combine it with Gochidza, Fructus Lychee, which was our first, very first Spurbserb. So you can always look that up. Sha Yuanzi, Semen Astragalae Complianati, and Tu Sidza, Semen Cuscude. And then blurred vision from liver deficiency adds Shijue Ming, Contra Haliotitis, and Gochidza, Fructus Lychee. For superficial visual obstruction, use Miming Hua with Mudze, Herba Equisetti Hyamalis, Ye Ming Sha, Excrementum, Verspertilonius Marini. When I was typing this in, I was like, oh no, I'm going to have to pronounce this. Verspertilonius. Well, excrementum means excretion, so stool. So this is obviously an animal. I'm not sure exactly which animal. I should have looked that up. And Chantui periostracum cicadae, which is an insect. That's the outer layer. So the cicadas will molt, and they'll leave an outer layer of their exoskeleton, and that's what this is, Chantui. And for itching eyes, use it with Mangjingzi or Fructus viticus, Fengfeng, Radix sapashnikovia, which we just talked about a couple episodes ago, Jingjie, Herba schizonepidae, and Juhua, Floss chrysanthemum. So Juhua, as you see here, was mentioned. There were several that were mentioned a couple times. But Floss chrysanthemum is actually a very, very commonly used herb, very, very commonly used herb for all kinds of eye conditions. When I went to China, we saw all over the place. When we go to a park or something, there were always people there with their teacups. And in it, you could see the Floss chrysanthemum. They all, and I talked to them, I said, yeah, the older people, they all drink Floss chrysanthemum, and maybe even some of the gochidza, the lychee that we were talking about earlier. So that's sort of the tea that they drink all day, sip all day long. By the way, delicious. That would be a delicious combination, but also very helpful for the eyes. That's why they drink it. So what is the contents of Mingguang? According to Bensky and his team, the contents of Mingguang include flavonoid glycosides, including Budleo glucoside. I always like to include the ones that seem to be specific for this particular herb. That's one of them. But there's one that's not necessarily specific to this herb, but still very important, is linarin. Is particularly abundant. It may have anti-cancer, anti-osteoporotic, anti-Alzheimer, antioxidant, antimicrobial, and maybe neuroprotective, help the nerves, and help sleep and osteoarthritis. So that's an interesting, a lot of people consider that to be one of the real important active ingredients for this herb. And it may also protect from the sun as well. So linarin is an interesting, and that protection from the sun goes back to that skin ad that I was talking to you about earlier, that's that are protected against UV. So there you go. There is some evidence that it does protect against UV, protects against the sun. There are also triterpene glycosides, including mimengoside A and B, mimengoside AB. That's the Chinese term, mimengua. And then also iridoids and iridoid glycosides and phenolic glycosides. So these are all part of the contents. So there you go. Science behind this. So Chen say this herb can be antispasmodic based on a rat study and diuretic based on a rabbit study. I'm not a big fan of animal studies. I don't think they have any. They may be an indication of where we should do some human research, but in and of themselves do not indicate what happens in humans. So take these with a bit of a grain of salt. And if you think about it, antispasmodic and diuretic have nothing to do with its traditional effects. So I don't know if they happen or not, but there's an indication from further research would be what I would say. They also discussed two clinical studies where this herb is used in a formula with other herbs, which I don't usually, include, because when you have a big formula, and maybe my Western bias, but when you have a big formula, is it all the herbs in a specific combination? Is it a couple of the herbs or one herb that's really doing the main lifting and everything else is supporting it? When you get into a formulation of herbs, a formula of herbs, I don't know if saying, because this herb is part of that formula, then this is doing this. I don't like that equation, but here we are. So used in formulas, clinical trials, There's one in a formula. This was in the formula of herbs to treat conjunctivitis, which is inflammation of the conjunctiva of the eye. So it makes perfect sense that it'd be used. But that only had an N of 10. So there were only 10 subjects, which means it's not statistically valid. You need at least 30 to 40 subjects before there can be statistics effectively applied. So take that with a grain of salt. And also a different formula used for corneal ulcers. So corneal meaning the cornea of the eye. And the N here was 121. So now we're into statistically valid. It's still a relatively small study, but at least statistically valid study. So there you go. And again, part of the formula, not the whole thing. Drug-herb interactions, mimengua, has a diuretic effect, and that may lead to an increased elimination of water and or electrolytes. This is according to a paper written by John Chen, just one of the Chen and Chens, before his book was written. Again, I'm not sure I'm buying the diuretic effect, and this is what we would call an expert opinion. So it actually has no evidence to support it, so it's D level of evidence. Still something to kind of keep in mind as you're prescribing this herb, but nothing that I would say is a real solid interaction here, just something to, like, okay, let's keep an eye on it. A literature search did not find any potential cytochrome P450 or transporter protein interactions. And the American Herbal Products Association's Botanical Safety Handbook, which classifies an herb's potential for interactions, does not have an entry for this herb. So we don't know what they think of this. Again, just reflecting that this is not one of the most common herbs out there. There are some concerns about this herb. Bensky and his team say under toxicity heading. So they have a caution and contraindication heading. The only thing it said there was look under toxicities. So usually you'll get different things at each of these headings, but this one's toxicities. And says this herb is slightly toxic due to its acacetin content. Although there are no reports of toxic reaction, the herb should be used with caution. Overdosage must be avoided as it may cause the following side effects: dizziness, vomiting, dyspnea or trouble breathing, numbness of the extremities, or tremors. I'm not worried about its toxicity, but, you know, I'm not going to dose this to someone to that point. So, okay, well, that it was our herb for today. So thank you for joining us. We started our podcast today with a discussion of the Chinese medical pulse and tucked into some of the basics of taking and understanding a pulse. Then we discussed mimenghua, not one of the most commonly used herbs in Chinese medicine, but still quite useful under specific circumstances, especially in treating several different eye conditions, especially when liver is involved. And there you go, an interesting look at some useful Chinese medicine. Our next episode, we'll be looking at another herb of the world, the apple of Sodom, or Calotropis procera. This is a super interesting herb with literally biblical implications and some real toxicity. But can it be used medicinally? Since that is our mission, safe to assume it can be. Let's find out. And as usual, we'll be exploring something a little different. Is going to be a really interesting episode. Well, they all are, but this one is going to have some religious significance in addition to medicinal significance. Please join us for the next episode. It's going to be, as always, fascinating. Thank you very much for listening. Appreciate it. If you like this podcast, please do us a humongous favor. Subscribe to it in your favorite podcast app. That is really helps us quite tremendously. I appreciate it. And you can get this course as continuing education. Get more info on my upcoming integrative nutrition series at www.integrativemedicinecouncil.org. That's Integrative Medicine Council, CONCIL.org. And you can always get in touch with me at drgreg@spurbsherbs.com or at our website, www.spurbsherbs.com. Thank you. I haven't really talked about this, but if you notice there's some interesting colors in the background of the herb, I'm trying to color code things. I'm started this a little bit ago, and this is sort of the key to the color codes. And so you can kind of just by looking, if you learn these, I don't expect anyone to learn them, but who knows, some people, I'm not a visual learner, some people are, so maybe it's helpful for them, but I'm starting to color code the pictures, and here's the key to all that. And as usual, we have our extensive bibliography. The proceeding was presented by Dr. Greg Sperber. We would like to thank Janelle for all her support and everybody else who contributed to this program.
Janelle.
Timothy Dobbins.
Roger Campbell.